Sam, Theodore wouldn't listen to it, and swore that if Rassam wrote to Napier, that would be an end of their friendship. So, off they went to Magdala, but Rassam slipped the letter to me, begging me to persuade Theodore to look at it. He was no fool, Rassam, for he and the others were barely out of sight when Theodore bade me give the note to Samuel, who read it to him. It was a strange, courteous request for the release of the prisoners, and for a long minute I hoped against hope as he stood frowning in thought. But then he lifted his head, and I saw the mad glare in his eye.
"It is no use. I know what I have to do."
He turned on me.
"Did I not spend the night in prayer, and do I not know that the die is cast?"
Since he'd spent most of the night getting blind Blotto and thereafter roaring for his whore, I doubted if his decision had been guided by prayer much. I think the effect of his massacre was still at work in him, but I'm no mind reader. All that mattered was that the last chance of a peaceful issue had gone, and it behoved all good men to look after number one and bolt at the first chance. It never came. He kept me with him all day, and since he was never without his bodyguards, to say nothing of servants and his generals coming and going, I could only wait and watch with my hopes diminishing. Plainly the grip was coming, and the question was, when he went down to inevitable bloody defeat, would he take his prisoners with him? Fear said yes. Common sense said no. What would be the point? But with a madman, who can tell? There was a terrific thunder plump at about noon, and then the sky cleared for a while and the heat came off the ground in waves. It was breathless, stifling, and even when the cloud thickened and the rain began to fall in big drops, it brought no coolness with it. 5 miles away, although I didn't know it, Napier's battalions were fording the muddy Bekello barefoot, and climbing out of that mighty ravine in sweltering heat, short of water because the river wasn't fit to drink, breasting the long spur that brought them to the Ifitchu Plateau that I'd marked on Fasil's sand table, and coming near exhausted to the edge of the Aragi Plain. That was the main column. The second force came up the King's Road, which I'd warned Napier to avoid, and he almost paid dear for ignoring my advice. Runners brought word to Theodore of our army's approach, and from early afternoon the Ab army, 7,000 strong, was moving into position from the Islangi Plain to the lower slopes of Fala and Salesi. Theodore himself, with his generals and attendants and your reluctant correspondent, went up the muddy slope to the gun emplacements on the Fala summit. And looking back, I had my first proper sight of what Napier would be up against. Rank upon rank of robed black spearmen and swordsmen and musketeers, swinging along in fine style, disciplined and damn businesslike, with waving banners and their red robe commanders, 500 strong on horseback, marshalling them to perfection. I didn't know what force in guns and infantry Napier might have, but I guessed it wouldn't be above 2,000, and I was right. Odds of 3-1? But that wouldn't count against British and Indian troops, unless something went wrong, which it damn nearly did. From the Fala summit, we got our first sight of the approaching columns, almost 3 miles away across the great expanse of rock and scrub on the far side of Aragi. Theodore was like a kid in a toy shop with his glass, turning to me bright with excitement and bidding me look and tell him who was who and what they were about. It had begun to rain in earnest now, with lightning flashing in the black clouds and a strong wind sweeping across the summit, but the light was good. Theodore's glass was a first-class piece, and when I brought it to bear, I almost dropped it in surprise, for the first thing I saw was Napier in person. There was no mistaking him, for like old Paddy Goff, he affected a white coat, and there he was, a tiny figure sitting on his pony on a knoll about 2 miles away with his staff about him, and not a thing between him and us except some Bombay and Madras sappers skirmishing ahead of his position. No place for a general to be. And it was with some alarm that I traversed the glass and got an even greater shock, for I could see that the bug-hunting old duffer was courting catastrophe all unaware, and I wasn't the only one who'd noticed. His own position, with the first column still some distance behind him, was dangerous enough, but over to the right, coming up the King's Road, was the second column, and it was led by a convoy of mules, barely escorted, with supply train written all over them. Rations, ammunition, equipment, the whole quartermaster's store of the brigade simply begging for some enterprising plunderer to swoop down on them. And here he was, at Theodore's elbow, leaping with excitement at the heaven-sent chance. He was old Gabry, the Ab Field Marshal, who'd come thundering up.